Hello, hello everybody, and thanks for tuning in to this episode of Causes or Cures. I'm Dr. Eeks, your host, and hope you guys are doing well and having a good start to your 2023, or at least making the best of it. So I'm excited about this episode because I've always been interested in how man's best friend, dogs, can help improve our health. For example, there is their unerring devotion and companionship, which helps boost our moods and keeps the blues at bay. They can be great workout partners and help keep us fit. My dog Barnaby is my workout partner, and you'll know that if you watch my Instagram or YouTube videos. usually I work out with a hat, and he always steals my hat. It's like this thing we do, but we're both getting exercise, so it's good. But dogs can also be trained to help manage or detect specific diseases. In today's podcast, we'll be focusing on detection, particularly how dogs are being trained to help detect Parkinson's disease, and specifically early detection. And we will talk more in the podcast about why that is important. My guest today is Dr. Mandy Gula. She is a holistic physician and founder and medical director of the Living Medical Arts Center that serves the San Juan Islands. And today she will be chatting with me about the PADS for Parkinson's program, which is the first program of its kind in North America that teaches dogs how to detect an odor associated with Parkinson's disease. Her dog is actually one of the biodetection dogs in the program. So in the podcast, she'll tell us a little more about the work she does, then she'll provide a quick overview of Parkinson's disease for folks who may not know much about it. She'll talk about a dog's sense of smell and how good it is. We know it's good, but how good? When we first detected a specific odor for Parkinson's and what might cause that odor, how did that happen? How did they train the dogs to detect it? She'll talk about how accurate the dogs are at detecting that odor and more specifics about the dogs that join the program. Finally, she'll discuss the overall goals of the program as it relates to Parkinson's disease and why they're so important. So I hope you guys enjoy this one and give me a minute to connect to Dr. Gula. Oh, and just really quick before we connect, I want to thank Lisa Holt, who is the program director of the PADS program, for helping me set this up. So I reached out and she was kind enough to connect me to Dr. Gula. So now, one second, and let's connect to Dr. Gula. All right, guys, we are connected here to Dr. Mandy Gula, and we're going to talk about PADS for Parkinson's, which is a really interesting topic. But first, can you tell us a little bit about you and the work you do and how you got involved with PADS?
I have been a practicing naturopathic physician about a dozen years, and I own and operate my own practice here on the San Juan Islands called Living Medical Arts. And I've always been really interested in the way that dogs can interact in a practice with the oxytocin that they bring. I think even therapy dogs, they warm up a practice for young people and anxious people, and often they feel more comfortable if there's a dog around. So I've always been really interested in that. And learning about Lisa Holt's work, being like the first and largest Parkinson detection work group in the entire world, just I really wanted to be involved. So I've been really excited to work with her. She's unbelievable. I think that she is so dedicated to trying to figure out what the dogs are smelling and how we can detect Parkinson's early and help people. It's been an honor to work with her and my dog Piglet. We really enjoy doing the work itself. And then also we're involved in the research part of it, which is exciting also.
And just for our listeners, I just saw Piglet on video. I know this is an audio podcast, and he's absolutely adorable. The little rat terrier mix. Yeah, what a cutie. So I thought maybe, some people don't know a lot about Parkinson's disease, or they know maybe like kind of like a general overview. So I thought, like, could we start there? Just tell people kind of generally what it is and what goes wrong.
Parkinson's is a clinical diagnosis. So It's made on a person's history, symptoms, and physical exam. And right now, there's not any specific labs or diagnostic imaging or testing that is like the ultimate gold standard for Parkinson detection. It's a conglomeration of all of these different symptoms and things that can be signs that can be seen. And there are certain tests that can be helpful, like a brain MRI can be helpful. There's a dopamine transporter scan or a DAT scan that can be helpful. There's a skin biopsy currently, which is an invasive test where they are actually taking a little bit of the skin, so it's painful, and they're looking for alpha-synuclein, and that's actually currently the most diagnostic test that they have. There is Manchester just released a study and a statement saying that they're going to bring to market a swab that will be able to look for Parkinson's within 3 minutes. That they, So that's really interesting. They talked about how they've identified 500 separate molecules specific for Parkinson's patients. So when that comes to market, that will be amazing, but we don't currently have that. And we kind of Parkinson's alert dogs, which is what PAD stands for. And then there's also some blood work that can be helpful, but we still don't 100% know. Like there's this new alpha chain test that looks at degradation of neurological tissue, neurofilament test, but it doesn't seem, we're not really sure whether it's helpful in Parkinson's. They know it's helpful in Alzheimer's. They know it's helpful in dementia. They know it's helpful in MS. It's kind of like, maybe it's helpful in Parkinson's. So there's some blood work that can be done. And there's also this malassezia that is found like on the scalps and sebum of about 80% of people with Parkinson's. So there is.
A lot. So there's a lot going on in this area. Like, I guess try to figure it out. It's a scary diagnosis for sure. I saw someone in my family go through it. So PADS, it's the first program of its kind in North America to train dogs to detect an odor associated with Parkinson's disease. And I've been so interested in like dogs' sense of smell and being able to detect certain types of diseases and that kind of thing. I joke about it. Actually, I have a joke with people like because I don't like to go to the doctor. I know it's bad, but like I don't, I have like the whole anxiety thing, and I'm like, well, my dog sniffed me today and didn't look too concerned, so okay, that's like my running joke with some of me and my friends. But can you tell us, for people who don't, we all know dogs have a good sense of smell, but how good is their sense of smell?
Yes. So there's a couple ways to think about it. A dog can detect 1 teaspoon of sugar in water equivalent to 2 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Another way, if you were to compare it to a visual sense, a dog could stand on the West Coast and see the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, that's one. That one's cool. I like that one.
40% of dogs' brains are dedicated to odor detection. So they can actually inhale and exhale at the same time while they're breathing and have odor detection separate. And they're the way to think about it is like a giant bingo board. Dogs have about 295 million numbers on that board, and humans have about 5 million. And it's not all about the number of receptors, it's about the combination. For example, like number one, 1250, 400 could light up, and that equals bacon. And they're able to, on this huge bingo board, pick up all these separate scents and then link them together to a specific odor. So their ability is infinite. And there's nothing that we have anywhere in any of our capability that in any way comes close.
Wow. That's yeah, I mean it's remarkable. It's truly remarkable. Now, PADS has been training dogs to detect Parkinson's since 2016. I think that's the year I wrote down here anyways. But can you walk us through the history of when they first detected an odor for Parkinson's? And they said this odor is associated with Parkinson's.
Yes. So Joy Milna was a nurse, and she was married to a physician named Les. And she always talks about loving the way that he smelled. And about 10 years into their marriage, he came home with what she described as like a nasty, yeasty odor. and became less impatient. I mean, less patient, more moody. And they had this episode one night where he shook her in the middle of the night, and she took him to a neurologist for a full evaluation. And he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease at 45 years old. And so she was a nurse, he was a doctor. So they went to a Parkinson support group. And when she was there, she realized that like everybody basically smelled like him, and that she could smell it. So there was a researcher in the group. His name was Tilo Kunath, and he worked at the University of Edinburgh. So they did an experiment in 2015 where they gave her six t-shirts of people that had Parkinson's, six t-shirts of people that didn't. They had them wear the t-shirt overnight. And then they asked her to give a score to see how strong the odor was and whether or not she could smell it. And she was 100% accurate. She was even able to text someone that was in the control group that was later diagnosed with Parkinson's. So that same year, Nancy and David Jones heard about the experiment in October of 2015. And Lisa Holt talked to them, and they decided that they would, if a human could smell it, there was no doubt that a dog couldn't smell it. So they started doing like a citizen science project, basically completely self-funded, in January of 2016. And by March of 2016, they had seven dogs, and two of them are still in the program, Mia and Rowan, and they're both over 10 years now. Old now. And there's some decline in olfactory ability in dogs as they age, and some certain trainers will take those dogs out, but Lisa's really passionate about keeping the dogs in, and even though they have a little bit less specificity and sensitivity. Mm-hmm. So that's our story. And I just wanted to go back to that first question, just that there is a diagnosis criteria that was put out, hold on one second, by the International Parkinson's Movement Disorder Society. And it's basically the number one thing is you have to have slowness of movement, which is called bradykinesia. And then you have to have one, you can have one or three of the other ones, which are shaking or trembling of a limb that occurs while at rest, stiffness or rigidity of the arms, legs, or trunk, and trouble with balance or falls. So that's the clinical diagnosis picture that you see. And then we talked about the diagnostic tests.
Right. So that's amazing, like that a woman could just smell. I've never heard of, like, I mean, I guess other humans can smell different, you know, pick up, but like just to, for her to pick up, this is like a disease specific smell, that's remarkable that a human could do that. just kind of, wow. Do they know like what causes this odor?
They know it's coming from the sebum. And I actually was just looking at spironolactone decreases sebum. That's one of its mechanisms of action, and that's used for acne. And I was looking at whether or not it affects Parkinson's patients and it actually aggravates them, which I think is so interesting. So there's something that's secreted in the sebum, and they don't know, you know, like, do the Malassezia like the sebum? Is it related to it? Because it's like 80% of patients. Is it something that's really delicious to certain molds or fungus or something like that? It's a metabolic process. Like the Manchester study is showing that there's like 500 separate molecules in a Parkinson patient, or different levels of molecules than you would see. They didn't release what those molecules are. And it's unclear whether they're volatile organic compounds or if we even know what those compounds are. But we'll find out. It seems like maybe they'll release that.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's, I'm going back to like, she was able to pick up somebody in the control group. Like, wow.
Early detection. And that's the whole idea. And we have someone in our assessment pool who was brought in, who had a genetic predisposition for Parkinson's in her 40s, but no symptoms at all. And the dogs actually called her positive. And so they ordered a skin biopsy test, and it was positive. And now she's working with Dr. Laura Meashley, who's an ND, Masters of Public Health, that specializes in Seattle in Parkinson's and early detection and treatment, to try to work on lifestyle changes to try to help slow the progression. Even though she doesn't have symptoms, she's still secreting positive molecules. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I have a question about early detection, you know, why it's so important later down the line here. So how does PADS train the dogs to distinguish Like this is the odor associated with Parkinson's disease versus a control. Can you walk us through some of that process?
They go through the normal process that dogs do for odor detection. And then at that point, we had been using t-shirts, but this year we've switched to using swabs, which has been a really interesting process. The t-shirt, like we talked about with the bingo board, is like one of the scents that they smell that's part of the like positive odor. So we had to actually wean them off the tissue smell as we incorporated just the swab smell. And that happened this year, which has been a really amazing process. But generally in the past, patients always spent the night an overnight t-shirt, and it was freshly washed, never before worn t-shirt by the same manufacturer. And we have a room that has four samples. Each of those samples is separated, I think, by about 4 to 6 feet. Lisa knows the exact parameters of how they're separated. We have two blank controls, one human sample, and we have a hot sample. And the dogs are rewarded on positive, PD positive samples. And once a week on Mondays, we have a new sample that the dogs don't know if it's positive or not, basically. And they work that sample. So the other days are all days that are used to reinforce the original odor, which is important for their confidence. So there's a long time of like building the dog's confidence around what is the target odor and being able to distinguish it, because it's a conglomeration of different molecules, separate it from the controls and separate it from the human in order to get the Parkinson diagnosis. So it's about a year process that the dogs go through in order to be able to detect it. And
oh, okay. So at the end of the year, they're like, okay, now you're ready to go out and, okay.
And all the detection is always done in this one room. It's not like we do this with humans in a setting where there are people. The people will always send in samples, and we will always work those specific samples in a room. I know people always worry about that. Like, is your dog going to like diagnose me as Parkinson's, as having Parkinson's? Yeah. And you never know. It's not like that. Like, they're alerting on a specific sample that is of the sebum.
Ah, so people would send in samples.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So it's not like they're going to walk in the room and start barking at the person and the person's going to have it, you know. Okay.
Exactly.
Got it.
People, doctors can send in samples to PADS. They can send a prescription, and PADS will send them a collection kit, and they can send us a sample as part of a diagnostic picture of whether or not they have molecules associated with Parkinson's.
Now, how accurate are the dogs? Do we know?
Mm-hmm. There's currently 18 dogs in the program, and the dogs range in accuracy and change in accuracy over time. So they have a range between 85 and 95% sensitivity and 80 to 95% specificity as a group. The current trend in the last 1.5 years, not including the last month, which was the lowest that we had seen because we were transitioning off of t-shirts onto swabs. So we lowered our numbers, and we were at 88 sensitivity, 86% sensitivity and 86% specificity. And in transitioning to the swabs, and before that we were at 91 and 88. And there are some of the dogs that are as high as 98 to 100%.
Wow. So that's pretty good. So we're talking really about like how good are they are not getting, I guess, false positives and false negatives, right? Essentially.
Yeah. And one of the things they do is they have a larger group of dogs so that we make sure that we get the appropriate like sensitivity and specificity. You wouldn't, okay. If you didn't have as many dogs in the program.
So does one sample go through just one dog, or is it multiple dogs, or no? Okay.
All the dogs, if you can imagine, there's a room, and in the room there's four samples, and all of us have our dogs, and they're on a leash, and we're all lined up, and each dog comes in independently into the room, and it's like a puzzle, and they work the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And they alert on the sample that is the Parkinson patient.
Oh, wow.
That is the way that it works. Okay. And so we all work one sample. And we work that sample in different locations of the room. Like the sample moves around the room. And because smell is like a puddle, right? Like it comes down off of things and flows down, like off of tables and then up walls. And sunshine makes it, anything that's warm will collect scent. And as the dogs move through the space, they move the odor also through the space, which also decreases sensitivity and specificity because the odor is less concentrated in one area. So there's a lot of factors that go into whether the dog can detect, is detecting and alerting on that specific odor.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, I was reading on the website, I believe that pads, or you guys hope that the dogs will be able to identify like specific molecules. And you mentioned before it's kind of like there's a bunch of molecules. Are you guys working on that?
Yes. So PADS has established a collaborative research relationship with an organization called Canary that uses AI technology. And it's the same technology they use to allow self-driving vehicles to see. And they're making an olfactory map and basically using a mouse model as the bingo board. And it's called a bioelectronic nose. So they're connecting the nose because their noses are so much better to our current technology. And it's actually significantly easier than doing a 3D map for driving because olfactory map is actually flat. So the whole idea is that the map lights up in certain areas when the mouse model sees the different odors. And so you get this map. And over time, it lights up at those specific molecules or those specific areas. So you can see even one of the challenges is that basically, our molecular databases are similar to a fingerprint model. So even if we find a volatile organic compound, but we haven't identified it in organic chemistry, we can't actually like link it to the molecule because there's no name for it. But if you have a map, then you can say like these molecules light up over and over and over again, and whether or not we have a name for it, it's just like the bingo board. It's like what of those specific molecules are lighting up, and you can literally see it as an image. It comes up as an image.
That's cool.
So they're
That's so
working
cool.
on mapping that to figure
Yeah.
out what it is that the dogs are smelling. And it
Wow.
definitely is the case that some people have Parkinson diagnosis and the dogs don't alert on them. So there are, it does seem like there's some variation of pathophysiology maybe in Parkinson's disease. And then there's some variations of degeneration of the dopamine receptors and movement disorders that are really similar. And the dogs can alert on some of those also. So some dogs are more sensitive or specific than others, and some generalize more than others. So this
Interesting.
new thing is called a BEN or bioelectronic nose. And the PADS dogs are actually feeding the samples to the bioelectronic nose of what is positive and what is negative. So that is currently happening to try to build this database. It's really exciting.
That is so cool. I've been hearing so much about AI lately and all different avenues, but that's neat. And I guess you could maybe eventually identify a biomarker, maybe. I guess that
That's
would
the
be
whole
the
goal.
goal. That's the
Yes.
goal.
What is the biomarker? What are these
What is
biomarkers, and how can we test for it early?
right? Because that's really now. Can you also talk about how the dogs could help with misdiagnoses? Do they do that specifically at PADS? No.
Not specifically. Like they'll either alert as yes, there's this group of molecules, or no, they don't have it.
And
So
okay, that makes sense.
they can potentially help with whether or not you need to do a more invasive test. Like if the dogs don't alert, then maybe there doesn't need to be a skin biopsy test or an MRI or a dopamine transporter scan. And that might prevent somebody from having like an invasive or expensive test.
Right. That makes sense.
So it could be a deciding factor for people.
And I also read, I believe, also on the website, that the dogs could potentially be used or are being used. You'll have to tell me which one to see if treatment is working.
Not currently. There's
Not currently.
no current studies, as far as I know, worldwide. But you could potentially put them to that riddle if the if we right now Parkinson's, is considered like the slow march to death. Very few people have full recovery from Parkinson's. So if and when we have that point where people are seeing real recovery, then I think you could see, are the dogs still alerting on that person? But right now, a lot of Parkinson's patients just continue to degenerate slowly.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Okay, so let's jump to the dogs in the program. I saw Piglet, and is there like a qualification program to get in? Different ages, different breeds? Is it a mix?
So all the dogs are cute, and it's a huge mix of dogs. So from 4 pounds to like almost 200 pounds, and there's a huge variety of like both purebreds and mutts in the program. And what's more important, well, age does matter. So Lisa does prefer that they're less than 5 years of age, but there's been a couple dogs that have entered the program that are 8 years of age, and that would be the cutoff, just because the olfactory sensitivity decreases with time, and they want the dogs to be successful. So the more important thing over breed or anything else is drive. So does the dog want to solve the problem? And is the dog trainable? Those are the two things. So dogs that like to solve problems are really great at it. It's like every time they come into the room, it's a different crossword puzzle. And she allows them to develop their own communication and work out their own ways of alerting. So each of the dogs does something different. Like some dogs lay down, some dogs drool into the container. Some dogs stick their nose, like mine, with his long snout, like right into the container. So there's in each one has their own alert, and she lets them develop that. So it's really awesome. I think some of the dogs are really fast. They run around the room in circles. Some dogs are really slow. So it's very interesting to see how they work the puzzle. But the most important thing is that they do, and that they're interested in doing it, and that they continue the drive of wanting to do it.
And when you say that their alert is different, like you mean like one dog might bark, another dog might, I don't know, raise his paw or something, or
Yes, exactly. Like some dogs, a lot of them put their head over the sample and they stick their tail out and their whole body is rigid. That is one of the most, that is the alert, and they hold for 3 seconds on the alert when they smell the odor. And different, ours is 3 seconds, but different training programs would do different things. But there's a full body motion. Some dogs sit in front of it and kind of like go into a praying position. They all do different things. Some dogs stick their nose like way down in the hole. So it's basically a canister that has the odor with a metal canister on top of it, and the dog so that the odor can come up through the canister so the dogs can smell it.
And you mentioned before that it takes about a year, but do you have to bring them in, regularly to train, or how time intensive? I mean, because you as the dog parent would have to go too, right? And
Yes, it's a volunteer program, and we all volunteer Mondays through Thursdays. And she likes us to come 2 to 3 days of the week, and some people come 4 days a week, and some of us come 2 to 3 days a week. It just depends on, and it's an hour, so 4 days a week, basically. And at the beginning, it's much more. We come every day, and then later we can come 2 to 3 days a week. So it's definitely a. Then we have little times of breaks, like we're on winter break right now, but it's definitely a year-long volunteer commitment.
and where is it located again?
We're on the San Juan Islands, which is a small island group off of Washington State up near Canada.
Oh, that's interesting. And so my next question is, I wanted to ask you as and I don't in your experience as a physician, as a from a health perspective, the dogs, you is the goal to get them to, diagnose early, and what does that mean for somebody who has Parkinson's, like, in terms of progression? I think you mentioned before another physician who does lifestyle modifications. I don't know if you do that at your practice and your work, but does that make a difference? If we're getting you're going to get early, and you can really slow this progression, or not so much.
One of the things that's so difficult to see in research is how lifestyle and diet modifications slow progression of disease. Because like it's the disease you don't see, right? So you can look at like quality years. As far as I know, there's been no research specifically looking at lifestyle and diet modification, looking at quality years specifically for Parkinson's patients, just to give you like a real mathematical number. But Dr. Laura Miechle, and I definitely do this in my practice as a naturopath, we're all about finding early detection, prevention, finding the cause, treating the cause. It's one of the things that we avow that we take, and then trying to work on every single level of strengthening the body and tonifying different systems to try to improve health on every level. So of course those things help. I mean, there's even a boxing program that we've been trying to incorporate onto the island that has been shown to really help with Parkinson's patients. So definitely physical exercise, the research is pretty clear, is really helpful for all neurological disease and even like reversing neurological aging. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with that new study looking at swimming, showing increased longevity. No,
I'm not. No.
So anyways, movement. Movement is good for us. There's like no doubt about it, regardless of what the diagnosis is. And so, and of course, like eating well and making sure you have proper nutrition and all of those like fundamentals of health, if you can get those in place, regardless of the disease, I think it's helpful. But there's neurologists that have talked about if we can find Parkinson's early, we might be able to slow the progression so that even in their lifetime, they never see the actual symptom picture and have to deal with all of the symptoms, because dopamine is an autonomic neurotransmitter. You get mood changes, sleep changes, GI changes, sleep disorders, depression, anxiety. Like there's this whole picture that happens with Parkinson's that can be really difficult. And also this inability to move your body over time.
Yeah.
Like they call it the slow march to death. That's because awful. Yeah, you lose ability. And some people really maintain cognitive ability and some people don't. And they are just trapped in their own body. And the research shows that it's supposed to bypass Alzheimer's as one of the most prominent neurological degenerative diseases within the next 10 years. So we want early detection. We want to find out like metabolically what is causing it. And then can we slow the progression of what is causing it? And until we have those pieces, I don't think we'll know. But the more information we have, the better we can plug in those pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say like the neurodegenerative diseases are the ones that frighten me the most, you know, and like the toll that they can take on, I don't know, it just out of everything, you know, and sometimes they, I mean, I know we're seeing disease, like we're seeing cancers early, you know, earlier onset cancers. I just had someone on my podcast talk about that. I'm not sure if we're seeing that same trend, you know, with neurodegenerative diseases, but you do see people like, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s getting it. And, yeah, like just the impact on quality of life and knowing like what's up ahead. It's just, it's awful. It's awful.
Mm-hmm. I know that like paraquat, which is a pesticide, is associated with Parkinson's because that's what they do to give like mice models Parkinson's. So there's definitely like, there's some association with toxicity, whether it's environmental toxicity, you know, and the nervous system is just so sensitive and the chemical milieu of our planet is just getting more and more concentrated.
I totally agree with you there. I talked to like my dad sometimes talks about that with some of the things he sees in animals, and I mean, and there's always like that causation isn't correlation thing, but sometimes I think companies can use that to kind of like hide out a bit. That's just my opinion, but like, you know, I think that it's when you see like something come in so often and then you hear about exposures, but then they don't necessarily have to run the test, right? The randomized controlled trial and before the exposure gets out there. So then you're kind of like left wondering, right? And you're up against these really powerful companies. I wanted to ask you just really quick, your naturopathic physician, is that, what's the philosophy, the difference in philosophy approach to health? Is there like a main difference versus like allopathic or
So there's allopathic, naturopathic, you know, osteopathic physicians, and we all take the same vow to first do no harm. So that I think is the same thing, but then we take other vows. Like we actually take a vow to teach our patients. There's a word, the root word of doctor is docere, and we vow to teach our patients how to take care of themselves. We vow to find the cause and to treat the cause. We vow for teach our patients how to live with prevention of disease. And there's also this idea of the vis medicatrix naturae, which is like the healing power of nature, that it's kind of the idea of homeostasis, how I think about it, that if you take away the things that are bothering someone and you give them the things they need, the body wants to come to homeostasis. Like the system wants to be in balance if you can find and remove obstacles to cure. So that's a really old sort of one of the things that we make a vow to do. So it's a little broader. Like we have to be a little more detectives because we got to figure it out. That's like the job is to figure it out metabolically. I kind of think of us as like the OGs of functional medicine doctors, because functional medicine was started by Dr. Pizzorno, and Dr. Joe Pizzorno is one of the founders of Bastyr, who's one of the, I teach at Bastyr as an educator. I teach at advanced IV therapy as an adjunct professor. And I'm also involved in the state and the Washington Association of Naturopathic Physicians. I sit on the board, and I'm very interested in helping increase naturopathic medicine, because in my opinion, it's just really good care, like a full, I think about it like a hammock under somebody, where you can really, I'm really interested in the team approach. I love working with specialists. I love working with primary care doctors. Like I love having a therapist and physical therapist on board, and just making sure that somebody is getting all their needs met with the gentlest, most effective approach. So that's what naturopathic medicine in my mind is all about.
I love that. And I agree with you. I love to have a variety of experts and opinions and different approaches. I that's how I live my life. But kind of, I don't know if people say it's holistic. The word holistic gets a bad rap, but I'm I would consider myself pretty holistic in how I approach life, you know? And that's kind of like what drew me to public health. I think it should be more of a holistic, it is innately holistic, but we tend not to, we're more of a responsive, like the mainstream is more of like responding to things after they happen. We're not very good at prevention. I'd say that for, you know, most things. I like the idea of preventing things before they happen. I mean, obviously at the population level, that's public health. And then, you know, obviously, you know, medicine's more individual level, but there's all sorts of overlap in there. But that's, yeah.
I would love to see more naturopathic medicine on like more a global level, but what we're seeing really is like this real constriction and kind of a rejection of natural medicine, like internationally. Like even in France, they've taken osteopaths and naturopaths out of their general system now. So if you're looking for a physician, they don't show up. Australia has now downregulated natural medicine. You see attacks on it in Sweden, in the United States. So there's a real kind of battle being fought, I think, internationally to try to offer this sort of medicine and really offer a holistic approach, because it's expensive, it's time consuming, and you need to train experts. And so the amount of time it really takes to do it well, I think there's kind of a pushback against that. And this sort of idea that I hear it all the time in medicine, like if you look, you're going to find something. It's like, but that's our job. Like that is our job. And there's this real minimizing of looking for things and a real fear around the concern around the cost of looking for things instead of really trying to get to the bottom of things. And I think that's really accelerating, unfortunately.
Heartbreaking.
Because I want to see freedom of medicine for everybody. I want to see all options on the table, all affordable for people and whatever they need. That's the most effective, least expensive. That's what they get.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, natural, pharmaceutical.
Yeah.
Functional.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's like just the affordability is like, I think a lot of people tend to ignore things, you know, because they just think, oh, it's going to cost, you know, a fortune. So let's put that off. Or it's not so bad, so I'm not going to go get it looked at. I have a feeling that that's pretty common. You know, I don't know if we can, I mean, if there's done surveys on that, but we all know that like healthcare is definitely not affordable, at least here. So yeah, there's lots of room for improvement and different perspectives to have a seat at the table. Which I believe is the right way, but I'm not in charge of anything. So just,
I'm not either, but I agree with you. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see that structural change to support physicians that are interested in really helping improve healthcare outcomes in the United States. Cause for all the money that we have very poor outcomes.
Terrible.
So it's like systemically flawed.
Yeah.
So how can we improve it? And part of that, I think, is supporting physicians in giving that level of care.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. I was just reading about obesity and like, like when we called obesity an epidemic, I always go back to this. Like there was an article written in JAMA in 1999 where the CDC director said obesity is an epidemic. We have to do something about it. And then look where we're at now. Like it's I think 19 states have over 35% of their adult population is, struggling with obesity, kids rates. We know that it's a risk factor for cancer. We know that it's a challenge, and there's so many things, that we have to fix: food, lifestyle, work structure. Lots of things need to be done. And then you see at the same time all these drugs entering the market, and I'm like, part of me is like, well, I hope those drugs help people. But when you read about like the billions of dollars, like they're the new blockbuster drug, it's like, okay, but it's such a failed story of prevention, and it really bothers me, because it's just we just like let this thing go, and then all of a sudden it's becoming this like huge blockbuster thing that everybody wants, oh, this drug is going to make us so much money and all the investors are happy. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I hope it helps people. I mean, I'm not if that drug can do some good, if someone needs it, but I'm like, it would have been, but for me, it's kind of like, oh, we should have maybe helped fix these issues a while ago and invested in prevention. And more of a holistic approach. It is a holistic approach, right? It's diet, sleep, stress, all of it relates, access to stuff. So yeah.
And that would prevent all of the years of damage from whatever was causing the obesity, generally poor lifestyle choices, right? And a lot of that, they call it the SAD diet, the standard American diet. It's all brown and white, and there's no color.
Yeah, that's
I
true.
think that
Like,
there's some change that's happening, right? Like with the slow food movement and the
yeah.
organic movement, which
Yeah.
is tricky because now there's pesticides that are organic pesticides that are approved. So,
Oh, I didn't even know that.
oh yes.
I always try to buy organic, but and it usually costs more, a little more. Which so now there's pesticides for,
Oh
oh, well,
yes.
and
Oh,
they're.
the big companies have been, because the whole idea was organic was that it was slow, small, local, sustainable farms, but it's really gotten derailed by large corporate money. But that's why as much as you can buy
Buy
local
local.
farms if you can. We have on the islands, we're so lucky. Sarah Pope put the San Juan Food Hub together, and we can order from like all the farms, and we have all these organic farmers, all of these people that do different kinds of meats all organically. I mean, we're kind of like in
Wow.
a the anti, someone said to me, like the anti-food desert belt, because it's like the food
Yeah.
is really, really beautiful here. The San Juan Islands passed the first like anti-GMO act, I think, maybe in the country for the farming.
Wow, that's amazing.
There's a
Wow.
lot of farmers, and they're very eco conscious here, which is
That's
amazing to have
great.
access to that kind of produce and food.
And you support the farmers too. That's key too. And I've heard that from a lot of farmers. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and there's the whole issue of like fracking there, and people were like, oh, don't sell your land. But then a lot of the farmers would say, like, well, people aren't buying our stuff, and not supporting us. And I'm like, you have to do that. And it's a healthy,
Yes.
yeah, and it's a healthier thing to do.
And the World Health Organization says that that is the way, like small organic farming is the way of the future. That instead of like growing something in Tennessee and then shipping it all the way to Washington, right? It just makes more sense to
Oh,
do it
totally.
locally.
Totally. And I do, we have like a farmer's market here in the city, and I do go to that all the time.
Nice.
I like it. It's great that they're able to do that. Come in, they set up little stands. There's a couple of them in the city. Yeah, that's fantastic. And the
And we have
island sounds
a Saturday
beautiful.
market. We have a co-op too, so I don't want to not give them props. So you can buy stuff other places too that are local and
Yeah.
organic. Definitely. We have a Saturday market and a
Those
fantastic
island, this
co-op.
sounds amazing. How many people are on the island? Or is it like several? It's a cluster?
Gosh, off the top of my head, I feel like it's 6 to 8,000 on this island. There's Orcas Island, Lopez Island. We're on the largest San Juan Island. And then there's some other, it's a whole island chain.
Is there like a ferry system? Like,
Yes.
oh,
There is
that's
a whole
cool.
ferry system. Yes, you should come up and visit
I
and come see
know
the
it sounds,
dogs.
I
You would
would
like it so
love
much.
it. I would. It sounds lovely. So
Lisa has been very generous about people coming in if they let her know in advance and watching the dogs work. And
amazing.
it's a really cool community thing that so many people have been involved with it for a long time. Like Nancy and David, that were the original ones that worked with Lisa in setting up the program. Nancy still sits on the board, and David actually passed a Parkinson's in 2018, which is one of their motivations of getting involved in the program originally. But I think it's like one of the coolest things about that. And yes, we have whales. It's true. There's orca whales and there's humpbacks, but there's Parkinson alert dogs here, which I think is like one of the neatest things ever.
There's probably time to see both. I would definitely want to see the whales too. That sounds like a great place to live.
Even the UW whales, the University of Washington has a lab here. Forgive me. Also, dedicated to like marine life. So it is a really great place to visit. It's a very large tourist destination.
Awesome. I'm going to look it up. I'm going to Google images and see, but it sounds absolutely lovely. And I don't want to take up much more of your time, but this was great. I want to thank you so much. I think it's an amazing program. I was so excited that you were willing to come on the podcast and do it. And for people who want to check out, it's just padsforparkinsons.org.
Yes. And we are a nonprofit 501c3, and we are almost all volunteer organized. Like everyone is a volunteer. So if you want to donate anything, even $5 makes a big difference with us. Cause you know, how those small organizations work. If you give more money, it shows community support.
Yep.
So even like $5 donations, we are like, woo. So you can donate on the website and you can get a receipt right on the website.
Great cause to donate for. Anyone's looking for any kind of like holiday donation for sure. And do you have a website for your practice?
I do. It's livingmedicalarts.com.
Livingmedicalarts.com. Okay.
And if you wanted to learn more about naturopathy, there is the Washington Association of Naturopathic Physicians, WANP.org.
Okay. I'll put those. Yeah, I'll find them and I'll share them in the podcast description. I like to learn too. I like to see what you know, other people's approaches and philosophies.
We're a small community.
Yeah.
We're not actually sure how many of our numbers. We're probably less than 10,000 of us in the country. I mean, we're really like a small group of physicians.
Yeah.
And many of us have masters of public health, like Laura Meashley that I was talking about, who's an ND in Seattle. Yeah. She has a whole Parkinson program. She even has a whole teaching program. If you want to give that resource, it's like $20 per class. And she talks about lifestyle and diet modifications that you can do for Parkinson's that she's made like very available because she has a master's of public health. So she's really interested in how to get this information out there for everyone.
Awesome. All right. I'll look into that too. And so, Dr. Willa, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
And it's been such a joy.
Yes, absolutely. This was great. I can't wait for the listeners to hear this. I was telling people about this podcast and everyone was like, that's so cool. So I'm excited to get that out there. Kudos to Lisa too, for all of this work and all of you guys. It sounds like a really special group doing really important stuff. It's so neat and so important. So
all the volunteers that have spent doing it all these years and the board, everybody that volunteers, it's just really amazing that they're all just so, they give so freely to try to help find the cause of Parkinson's.
I mean, that's amazing. That is amazing. So hopefully people will check it out and donate if they can. To me, it sounds like a great cause. So
thank you.
Absolutely. I'll stay in touch. Yeah, absolutely. And if I come out there, I'll definitely be, I'll go see the whales and I'll see the dogs.
So, likewise. I hope to hear from you soon.
Okay.
Thank you so for all your work.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Enjoy the rest of your day there.
You too.
Bye.
All right, gang. Thanks so much for listening. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing and sharing the episode. It's much appreciated. If you listen on Apple and leave a review, thank you. That helps a lot, especially for smaller independent podcasts. In the description, the episode description, and also on my blog at bloomingwellness.com, where I write, I will include links to the Pads for Parkinson's website as well as Dr. Gula's clinic in case you want to learn more about either. If you have a dog, maybe you're considering him or her for the program. After listening to all the good work these dogs are doing, I kind of feel like Barnaby should be doing more with his life. Nah, he's okay. He's okay. He's all fun and games, and you need that too, right? You need that too. All right. And now to continue with the tradition of closing with a quote. This quote is from The Unbearable Lightness of Being by Milan Kundera. Dogs are our link to paradise. They don't know evil or jealousy or discontent. To sit with a dog on a hillside on a glorious afternoon is to be back in Eden, where doing nothing was not boring. It was peace. Okay, I'll see you here next time. Bye-bye.